Eric Von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods, Fact or Fiction, by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. Eric Von Däniken's book and its sequels have created quite a stir. Almost 40 years later, there are still numerous websites devoted to the idea that extraterrestrials have not only visited Earth, but are responsible for the most impressive structure of antiquity, as well as for the miracles in the Bible. Here we examine a sample of the evidence that Von Däniken puts forth. There's been strong interest in extraterrestrials for almost a century now. Eric Von Däniken claims that extraterrestrials have visited the Earth again and again throughout history. Where is his evidence for this? See his book, Chariots of the Gods. Not only in UFO stories, but also, Von Däniken claims, in history and archaeology, in strange art forms that are seen in various primitive cultures, in impressive structures that seem to be beyond human capabilities to build, in stories of miraculous events in various materials from antiquity as well. Some samples of strange art forms. Here is one from Peru that Von Däniken claims represents a fellow in a spacesuit, and here another that Von Däniken claims is riding a jetpack, and that thing down below is the flame from it. Strange art forms. Here's one of the strange figures that is visible really only from up in the air, seen on the plains of Nazca in Peru. Impressive structures such as the Great Pyramids of Egypt, or less impressive in that way, but older, if you like, the circles, the stone circles at Stonehenge, and other megalithic monuments of England and Europe, or perhaps even more impressive in some sense, the stone heads on Easter Island, way out in the Pacific, thousands of miles from virtually anything else, and with these little headpieces on top of their heads as well. And then there's the miracle stories that we find in various ancient cultures and in the Bible in particular. The opening of the Red Sea, and in Ezekiel chapters 1 and 10, the strange device with the wheels at right angles that Ezekiel sees, which Von Däniken and some others claim to be space vehicles of some sort. Two different representations here in these pictures of what they might have looked like. Well, that's the sort of stuff that Von Däniken brings forward. We're going to respond to that in what we will call archaeology versus Von Däniken. And our approach here will be to look at some of Von Däniken's evidence and respond to it in the light of archaeology. One reason for this is it's easier to answer Von Däniken archaeologically than it is by means of other sciences. Some of the references we'll be using, some of the numerous books by Clifford Wilson, which the best known is The Crash Go the Chariots, a work that was actually not designed to respond to Von Däniken, but is helpful in that direction, is the work called The Ancient Engineers by L. Sprague de Camp. His front cover says, an astonishing look back at the ancient wonders of the world and their creations. Another is Thor Heyerdahl's work, Aku Aku, which deals particularly with Easter Island and these stone heads. So, let's jump in and look at some of this material. Baalbek is an impressive temple site in Lebanon, and figures significantly in Von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods on page 93 in the chapter he has, Ancient Marvels or Space Travel Centers. Von Däniken says, to the north of Damascus lies the terrace of Baalbek, a platform built of stone blocks, some of which have sides more than 65 feet long and weigh nearly 2,000 tons. Until now, he says, archaeologists have not been able to give a convincing explanation why, how, or by whom the Terrace of Baalbek was built. Russian professor Ogres considers it possible that the terrace is the remains of a gigantic airfield. Well, what do we know about Baalbek? Baalbek is a large temple complex about an hour east of Beirut. Here's a shot of the Temple of Bacchus, if you like, at Baalbek. And here the Temple of Jupiter, located on von Däniken's platform or terrace. Regarding big stones at Baalbek, the largest three stones in the Jupiter Temple are 64 by 14 by 12 feet, and they weigh about 800 tons, not very close to the 2,000 that von Däniken mentions. The largest stone on the site is this one, pictured here, which is 70 by 16 by 14 feet and weighs out at about 1,500 tons, so that's getting up towards 2,000 tons. Now, von Däniken claims that this was used as a launching ramp for sending ships back to space like that, huh? Well, most inscriptions at the site of Baalbek are in Latin, and so they would date to after 63 BC when the Romans took this part of the Middle East. A few of the earlier inscriptions are in Greek, so they're after the time of Alexander when he came into the East about 330 BC. The main platform was apparently not there when the Seven Wonders were enumerated, and that the Seven Wonders of the ancient world were enumerated about 200 BC. So since the platform doesn't make the list, one might suggest that it wasn't around at that time. The style of the temples at Baalbek back today are Roman in any case, and the Romans built their temples on platforms, following the example of the Etruscans that they had been influenced by. And so this temple on a platform looks like it is Roman, huh? We can't tell for sure, but that certainly looks that way. But still, we do have to say, regarding Baalbek, that somebody did move stones weighing 800 to 1,500 tons. And the question is, how did they do it? Well, we'll want to come back and think about that by and by. von Däniken is, as he says, a Sunday or amateur archaeologist. Well, there's a danger of amateurism in any subject, and that one is, one of them is making big theories which fit only a small portion of the data. Von Däniken also treats the ancients as ignoramuses, a popular but false idea. Let's look at Athens, Greece, to see something about that matter, that the ancients really were much more clever than most moderns are inclined to give them credit for. One of the sites not mentioned by von Däniken, but one of the more impressive ones from antiquity, is the Parthenon at Athens. Here is a reconstruction picture of it. It is much more beat down than that today. The Parthenon especially shows evidence of great sophistication in its design. Several optical illusions have been overcome by designing the pillars to be slightly bulging in their middles and by having the floor slightly humped. If this is not done, for a person looking at a pillars with perfectly straight sides, they look like they are a little narrow in the middle. And for a floor being perfectly flat, although you could perhaps tell that by pouring water on it, they look actually a little dished in the middle. So the Parthenon here is something that has some very sophisticated things done to correct for optical illusions. Now, we know something about when the Parthenon was built. When the Parthenon was built, 447 to 438 BC, we know who ruled Athens at that time, Pericles. And we know who was the architect for the Parthenon, and that was Phidias. Here is a bust of Pericles and another of Phidias. And there's no evidence from the building of the Parthenon that there was any help from divine charioteers. Another site we might mention, which again is not mentioned by von Däniken, is Jerusalem. Jerusalem has some fairly impressive structures in it as well. For instance, Herod's towers at the Joppa Gate in ancient Jerusalem, shown here on the right. According to the historian Josephus, Some of the stones in these towers were up to 25 feet long. Caesarea, on the coast of Israel, was an artificial port built by Herod the Great just before the time of Jesus. For the breakwater, Herod used concrete, concrete that would set underwater, and he also used some massive stones, stones up to 50 feet long. So that raises the question of how does one move big stones? Sprague de Camp raises that question and mentions that, in fact, that was done regularly by ancient engineers on page 10 of his book, The Ancient Engineers. To predict the wealth of the gods and the kings, says de Camp, military engineers built walls and dug moats around cities. In the lower Euphrates Valley, where there was practically no stone, walls were made of brick. But elsewhere, they were made of stone, and preferably the largest stones that could be moved. We'll come back and think about that by and by. What about the pyramids of Egypt? Well, here von Däniken has something of a field day. He says, regarding the pyramids on Chariots, page 96, is it really a coincidence that the height of the pyramid of Cheops, multiplied by 1,000 million, 98 million miles, corresponds approximately to the distance between the Earth and the Sun, that a meridian running through the pyramids exactly divides continents and oceans into exactly two halves, and that the area of the base of the pyramid divided by twice its height gives the celebrated figure pi, 3.14159. Well, we won't examine all of those, but we'll catch a couple of those here. This is a picture of Great Pyramid. It's the Pyramid of Cheops, or Khufu, commonly known as the Great Pyramid. The sheathing stone is missing, so that makes the exact value of the size of the pyramid a little uncertain. What about the value of pi? Well, Egyptians built fairly impressive chariots that they used for their warfare. We see an ancient picture of one of those right here. After making round wheels that don't bump, bump, bump too much when you're riding them, one can easily measure the value of pi to a decimal place or two. Most of the material mentioned by von Däniken on the Great Pyramid was in print a century ago. Secrets of the Great Pyramid by Peter Tompkins, I believe, dates back to early in the 20th century. The distance to the Sun is probably coincidence. Note that it's 5% off 98 million miles. Not an error spacemen would make, 98 versus 93 million miles. The question of the meridian through the pyramids divides the oceans and the land into equal halves. Any meridian drawn all the way around the Earth divides Earth into equal halves. Perhaps von Däniken intended to say divides the oceans into equal halves and the land into equal halves, that is, each of them into equal halves, but I think that's not correct. You'd have to take a look at a globe and see what you think about that. What about building the Great Pyramid? Well, the core of the pyramid, that is, Nakheni's sheathing stone, consists of some 2.5 million stones, averaging 2.5 tons each. Von Däniken scoffs at using rollers to move these stones. He says on page 94, I shall be told that the stone blocks used for building the temple were moved on rollers, in other words, wooden rollers. But the Egyptians could scarcely have felled and turned in rollers the few trees, mainly palms, that then is now grown in Egypt, because the dates from the palms were urgently needed as food, and the trunks and fronds were the only thing giving shade to the dried up ground. Well, one might say that not all palms are date palms, and that most people in a rather arid land like that don't get their shade from trees, but get them from buildings or tents or something of that sort. How did the Egyptians move big stones? Well, we actually have a picture from the wall of an Egyptian temple showing men moving a large stone statue. Here it is. And if you look at this picture, the head has been rather messed up on this, but right there in the middle left is the statue, and there's some kind of binding around it to perhaps hold it from falling off the device it's being carried on, but you can see, even though this is a line drawing and not in color or anything, that it is seated on some kind of a sled. And then to the right of the statue, there are four lines of men attached to it by ropes who are apparently pulling. There's a fellow standing on the front of the sled and pouring some kind of liquid out in front of the sled. There are some other guys below the sled carrying containers which are apparently this liquid, so it's warm probably, though it might be something like oil. That'd be rather expensive. It doesn't look like rollers were used in this particular case. It looks like a sled was used, something that would slide on the ground and with some liquid used to cut down the friction. So this picture carved on the wall of an Egyptian temple shows how they moved a large statue. A sledge is used instead of rollers, some liquid used to reduce friction. Estimating the weight of the statue, which is quite substantial, it would take only 8 men to move a 2.5-ton block by this means. So that doesn't sound too bad, although obviously 2.5 million blocks times 8 men would be 20 million men. But of course, after moving one block, they can come back and move another one. So you could use as many or few men as you want, depending on how fast you need to do this whole job. How long would it take to build the pyramid? Well, von Däniken estimates it would take 664 years for humans to build the Great Pyramid, so it was not done by men. That's on page 98. Ancient historian Herodotus, however, who interviewed Egyptian priests, but long after this pyramid was built, said that the priest told him it took 20 years. Clifford Wilson, to Crash Good Chariots, notes some objective evidence from a pyramid in Dasher, where two of the stones are dated. Wilson says this on page, Crash Good the Chariots, page 29. Another pyramid in Dasher actually has a date on the northeast cornerstone. It was laid in the 21st year, the pharaoh Seneferu. About halfway up, there's another date, this time dating to the same pharaoh's 22nd year. If the dating is accurate, and the two stones were placed at the date given, the maximum between the two would be under 2 years. This pyramid is about two-thirds the volume of the Great Pyramid. So this would suggest that if you multiply that by, say, 2 for a bigger pyramid, and then you figure that the upper part of the pyramid is going to take longer, it certainly doesn't seem that 20 years is way out of line for how long it might have taken to build the Great Pyramid. We also have some evidence in Egypt of a developing technology of pyramid building, which suggests that the oldest pyramids are not the most sophisticated, and that this doesn't look like something that highly technological beings from outer space would have had to go through this kind of development on Earth. The picture at the right shows the smallest types of pyramids, what are actually called mastabas, early and smaller tombs, just one-story buildings, right? But then, for kings, these mastabas are later elaborated, by stacking. Thus we come to have step pyramids. And here's a picture of a step pyramid from Egypt. And here we have the picture of the bent pyramid that starts off at a steep angle and then about halfway up goes into a shallower angle. We think the bent pyramid is an early attempt to make a smooth-sided structure in which the initial slope was too steep. It may have been some disaster that took place, and so they angled the slope in anyway, further on up. Here's the second pyramid, and finally they get it right. Well, this history of pyramid building, does this look like the work of an advanced civilization that has mastered interstellar space travel? I don't think so. We move from the pyramids of Egypt to Easter Island. Far out in the Pacific Ocean lies isolated Easter Island. The island is populated by some 200 humans and hundreds of huge stone heads. Another picture of stone heads. and another. Some of these heads even have hats on them, which are made from a different color stone. Did the inhabitants of Easter Island really build these statues themselves, or would it have required an super technological civilization from outer space to have come in and done this? Well, here's von Däniken's take on it, Chariots, page 110. Even if people with lively imaginations have tried to picture the Egyptian pyramids being built by a vast army of workers using the heave-ho method, a similar method would have been impossible on Easter Island for lack of manpower. Even 2,000 men working day and night would not be nearly enough to carve these colossal figures out of the steel-hard volcanic stone with rudimentary tools, and at least a part of the population must have tilled the barren fields, woven cloth, and made ropes. Well, there are a couple assumptions in there. The 2,000 men, he is pointing out that that's about 10 times the current population of Easter Island and such. But actually the question of how many men it would take depends on how fast you're going to operate with some qualifications. For this, we turn to Thor Heyerdahl. Do you remember Thor Heyerdahl? He's the fellow who built the Balsa Raft Kon-Tiki to drift across the Pacific. Also built a papyrus raft to drift across the Atlantic, etc. He also studied the stone heads on Easter Island, and here's the cover of his book, Aku Aku, The Secret of Easter Island. Von Däniken says on 110, it's impossible for only 200 inhabitants to set up several 150-ton stones. Heyerdahl disagrees, and while he was on Easter Island, he performed some tests using the current inhabitants of Easter Island and nothing but primitive tools. His tests show that 6 men could carve a head in 1 year. The whole population of the island could move a head to its site in a day or two, and 12 men could erect a head in 18 days. We see some of this illustrated here. Here are some of the men on Easter Island using techniques that they were told their ancestors had used, stones that already exist there, and using them to chip into the volcanic stone that the heads are made out of. And after working on that for a few days, they made an estimate on how long it would take to do this, and that a team of 6 men would take about a year to carve one of these heads. Moving the head, Heyerdahl says in Aku Aku, page 149-150, that after he had provided a luau for the island's inhabitants, 180 of them, with full stomachs, were easily able to move a 12-ton statue on a sledge they had made. Raising head, we have several pictures from the book on that. The men are taking poles to use as levers, and they lever up the top of the head, and they put stones under it, and then they lever up the head some more, and they begin to pile stones under it as they get it up higher and higher. And finally, they get it to the place where they are able to tilt it back, and it comes upright onto the platform. So Heyerdahl's results: 6 men could carve a head in 1 year, the whole population could move it to a site in a day or two, 12 men could erect a head in 18 days. So the island's current population could easily produce and set up one head per year if they were so inclined. So no reason to think then that this is beyond the capability of the ancients who lived on Easter Island. You only have to figure out why it is they thought it was sufficiently worthwhile to do something like this, and that we don't have a lot of information about. Nazca, Peru. The plains of Nazca are quite unusual in being crisscrossed by numerous lines, some of which give the appearance of highways or airport runways. Here we see a map that shows some of these lines on it. Another picture here taken from the air, and some of the lines do give the appearance of highways or airport runways. Besides these, we also see a number of animal and insect figures and such as that sort, And here we see one of those appears to be a monkey with a coiled up tail. These lines actually are rather strange drawings. They're drawings which one could go around the whole outline of the figure without crossing lines or anything of that sort. Von Däniken, in his book Gods from Outer Space, one of the sequels to Chariots of the Gods, says on page 115 and 117, archaeologists have been racking their brains over the geometric system of lines, animal drawings, and neatly arranged bits of stone which extend over an area some 30 miles long between Pulp in the north and Nazca in the south. To me, they look just like an airport layout. And then 2 pages further on 117, at some time in the past, unknown intelligences landed on the uninhabited plain near the present-day town of Nazca, built an improvised airfield for their spacecraft, which were to operate in the vicinity of Earth. That's Von Däniken. So, according to Von Däniken, the lines are runways for a spaceport. The large animals are only viewable from the air, so they are made by astronauts, page 34. And a trident on the coast points to the spacecraft, page 33 and 34, and figure 7, which I give you here with this trident on the coast. Well, how do we respond to Von Däniken here, which seems material seems impressive at first sight? Well, we point out, first of all, are these qualified to be runways? Well, in fact, when you get down and look at them, as this picture taken on the surface does, the runways are rather rocky. They cross hills. They are deeply furrowed at intersections. And the ground is too soft. So they're certainly not something you wouldn't want to roll anything on. In any case, if you've got some kind of hovercraft, that might be something else, though it's not obvious why you'd need long runways in that case. The large figures, as said, are typically made of one continuous line. Here's something we think is probably a hummingbird that falls into that category, as you can see here. The archaeologist who has spent most of her time on the scene and thinking through what's going on at Nazca is Maria Reike, who is quoted a number of times in Von Däniken. And she thinks these things were perhaps paths for dancing in some kind of sympathetic magic ceremony. Again, because we don't have inscriptions and such, we are speculating here, and the question then is whether Maria Reike's speculations are better than Von Däniken's speculations. How about the question of the trident on the coast pointing towards the spaceport. Do astronauts from an advanced civilization capable of traveling through space really need arrows to guide them to a spaceport? Think that through. Summary. Do all the strange figures humans have drawn have to actually exist or be realistic? What about unicorns? For that matter, what about some of the abstract, cubist, and other types of art in the 20th century? The more you read of this stuff, the more skeptical you become. So if you read a couple of Von Däniken's works, or if you read R.L. Dione's God Drives a Flying Saucer, or Joseph Blumrich's picture of Ezekiel's spaceships, you begin to suspect that something is funny here. When Von Däniken reads the Bible, I really shudder. Here's a quotation from Chariots, page 57. Undoubtedly, the Ark was electrically charged. If we reconstruct it today according to the instructions handed down by Moses, an electric conductor of several hundred volts is produced. I think he meant, I'm not sure what he wrote or whether the editor messed him up, I think he meant a condenser, okay, as you've got metal with wood between it, etc. And of several hundred volts would presumably mean capable of sustaining a voltage difference of several hundred volts. If in addition one of the two cherubim on the mercy seat acted as a magnet, not all clear how that would happen, the loudspeaker, perhaps even kind of a communication between Moses and the spaceship was perfect. That sounds to me like gobbledygook, and I think would to any person who was involved in electronics, electricity, and such things as well. Von Däniken's research methodology is scary as well, on page 58 of Chariots. The details of the construction of the Ark of the Covenant can be read in the Bible in their entirety without actually consulting Exodus. I seem to remember the Ark was often surrounded by flashing sparks, and that Moses made use of this transmitter whenever he needed help and advice. Well, I'm not sure where or when von Däniken wrote this, but Exodus not exactly a difficult book to find in Western civilization, being the second book of the Bible, and so available anywhere where Christianity and Judaism are reasonably common. And if he had consulted Exodus, he would realize that there's never any remark that the Ark is surrounded by flashing sparks, or that Moses made use of this transmitter whenever he needed help and advice. Well, that's our quick tour of von Däniken's claims. I recommend these books by Clifford Wilson, Crash Go the Chariots, The Chariots Still Crash, Gods and Chariots, and Other Fantasies. Wilson at least has a good archaeology background and a good understanding of what the Bible has to say, and does, I think, a helpful job in showing some serious problems with von Däniken. Some advice for those who are reading or listening to this. Proverbs 16:25, there's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. being sincere is probably not enough, but one should at least make an attempt to be sincere. And 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test everything. Hold on to the good. So in conclusion, Erich von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods, fact or fiction? Fiction. That's all, folks.